this particular retreat, we're talking about the three characteristics of existence as taught by the Buddha. The three characteristics in Pali are dukkha, anicca, and anatta, which respectively means roughly unsatisfying, impermanent, and no self, is the traditional interpretations. And yesterday we talked about dukkha, about the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned existence, meaning that the conditioned world is incapable of satisfying us permanently. It's incapable of giving us what we truly want, you know, what we truly want in our deepest heart. Each of these three characteristics can be portals or avenues for liberation. When we talk about dukkha, we talk about becoming aware of the causes of dukkha. By being aware of the causes of dukkha, by dissolving those causes, we become liberated. By seeing how craving and aversion and delusion feed dissatisfaction, feed suffering, feed dukkha, we can become liberated. And likewise, with the other two conditions of existence, they too can be avenues for awakening. And we'll talk about that. I'll talk about anicca, impermanence, first. And I'll talk about it first from a more theoretical point of view, and then perhaps more importantly from an experiential point of view, how you can work with it in your practice, how it can lead to awakening for each of us. On the surface, the anicca or impermanence means that everything changes. When we go beyond simply that surface teaching, we see there's a deeper aspect of it. And this particular aspect of it was revealed after the time of the Buddha, in the rising of the Mahayana tradition, several centuries after the time of the Buddha. But it was seen that not only is everything impermanent in the sense that everything is changing, but that impermanence is really the only reality in the conditioned realm. That it's not like there are things that are real and independent and discrete that are constantly changing, but it's that change itself is the inherent nature of reality. When we look at that in our world today, probably the closest approximation I could give to an example of change being the inherent nature of reality, and that is, if we look at sound, for example, sound is words or sound is music, we see that sound is nothing but vibrations. It's nothing but patterned change. There's no substance to sound. You can't put it in a box. It's not a thing. And yet sound is the way we communicate. Sound is the way we compose beautiful music. Sound is one way that we communicate information from one person to another. And scientists are seeing, as they penetrate more deeply into the nature of physical reality, is that there really is nothing there other than pattern. And so a number of scientists are saying that the fundamental reality of the universe is not stuff, not things, not material, and not even energy, but rather information. That the ultimate reality to the universe is, in a sense, consciousness. The universe, as one physicist said, I forget exactly who it was, but one well-known physicist says, the more I learn about the universe, I see it not as a great machine, but as a great mind. And so the Buddha saw, 2,500 years ago, long before the advent of modern science, in taking a very different road, an internal subjective road rather than an external objective road to study reality, came to essentially the same conclusion, that there is no inherent reality other than change itself. Now, experientially, we know that everything changes. At least intellectually, we do. We're particularly aware of this when someone dies or something, a relationship or a job or something that we cherish comes to an end. We're painfully aware of impermanence. But for the most part, in our everyday life, we don't embrace impermanence. We tend to live in a world of objects, a world of things. Our mind tends to thingify reality. We turn things into things, even if they're not things, you see. The universe is really a flowing process. But the mind wants to name things, and in naming things, it wants to conceptualize things. And in conceptualizing things, it wants to freeze them into bits of information that are unchangeable. As little children, as infants, our first experience of the world is that of impermanence. Sounds, colors, sensations, lights, just a dancing array of raw sensation. There's no object to it. There's no objectivity to it. It's simply raw experience. And eventually the mind begins to see patterns from that experience. The first pattern that it sees is the pattern of mama. And at one point, mama and I are basically the same thing. And we see that mama gives us what we want sometimes, and sometimes mama doesn't. And out of our relationship with mama, a sense of self gradually develops. And then out of that sense of self, there's other objects and other relationships will gradually develop. And the mind then coalesces into patterns of understanding. And those patterns of understanding then become our identification. And among those patterns of understanding are, as we talked about yesterday, the strategies that we develop for getting what we want and what we need. Language itself is a way of making things out of things that aren't things. We talk about the weather. Tell me, what is the weather? The weather is constantly changing. There's no one thing called the weather. We talk about it a lot. We may complain about it a bit. But there really is no such thing as the weather. It's simply a concept that we give to a particular realm of experiences that we have. If we think of another example, such as a river, we see that a river is constantly changing. And yet a river is a noun. It's a thing. We give it a name. And yet no one can really point to the river because it's constantly changing. You can't capture it in a bucket. You point to it 1 minute, and then you point to it a second later, it's a different river. We call the flow of the river, maybe that's the river, the pattern that it follows. But then if we look at the river over a period of times, we see that the river pattern itself changes. So there really is no such thing as the Missouri River or the Mississippi River. It's simply a name we give to a particular natural phenomenon, and we objectify it. In our Dharma practice, we have experiences. We name them. Pain, pleasure, good sittings, bad sittings. We objectify these experiences and then we try to capture them. We objectify the experience of pleasure and we try to get it and hold on to it. We objectify the experience of pain and we seek to get rid of it, to avoid it, or even destroy it if possible. A really good practice is to look at whatever we're naming and go beyond the name and say, what is this? What is pain? Well, there's no such thing as pain itself. There's all sorts of experiences that we label pain. There's tension, there's aching, there's burning, maybe itching, tightness. But that too is a label. What happens if we go into the experience itself? Well, gets a little more basic. Maybe we experience throbbing or pulsating or heat or cold. But ultimately, when we go beyond the words into the direct nature of the experience, it will take us beyond the experience itself. And we find that our concepts are an attempt to freeze a living, vital, ever-changing universe. And to a degree, that's necessary because we need to navigate our way through the world. We need to communicate with one another. It's helpful to have names for things. So it's not about throwing out words and throwing out concepts, but it's about recognizing that all of that is nothing but a map of a territory that's ever-changing and evanescent and ultimately ungraspable is the word. So in this particular practice called Vipassana or insight meditation, what we endeavor to do is to go beyond the conceptualization and the objectification of our experiences to the experience itself, directly, clearly. You know, I think a good example is a strawberry. Now, I could sit up here for the rest of the Dharma talk and talk to you about strawberries. If you never tasted a strawberry, all the words that I share with you, no matter how accurate they may be, aren't going to really tell you how a strawberry tastes. There's only one way to know what a strawberry really is, and that's to take a bite of one. And then as soon as we take a bite of one, we say, oh, that's delicious, or that's sour, or that's sweet. We develop a concept that strawberries are sweet or strawberries are sour. And that's what we live with. We freeze our experiences into concepts, and then we struggle with our concepts. So, working with impermanence can be a way of deepening our practice by going beyond the labels of this was a good sitting, this was not a good sitting, or this is pleasant, or this is painful, to the direct experience of what's really here. Because so often, when I work with people, I may hear someone say, oh, I really feel pretty good right now. And then they leave their experience. Then that's as far as they go. I'm good, everything's fine, I can go to sleep. I don't have to live my life. Or this is terrible. So there's a concept now. I develop a strategy for how to get out of terrible. So I reach for another concept. I take a pill. I meditate. I call somebody. Whatever our strategy might be. I analyze it. But what is this experience called feeling fine or feeling terrible? What is it? Going right into it takes us right into impermanence. And when we stay present with the immediacy of our experience in the moment, the first thing we see is that it's always changing. It's always changing. I'll work with folks, they'll say, oh, I've had this pain in my back for 3 weeks now. Just won't go away. Just, it's awful. Can't stand it. Okay. Can you sit there and bring your awareness into it? Okay. Yeah. Hey, it's gone. Where'd it go? Didn't go anywhere. What happens is the mind will react to the concept of pain, and that itself then locks the mind and the body into a pattern of resistance, which ironically perpetuates the pain itself. So it's the resistance to our pain that ultimately guarantees there will be more pain. And then when that resistance is contained within a label called pain, called bad, called shouldn't be here, then it gets locked up into almost like it's an identity. Kind of like the weather, or like a river, or like something that doesn't really exist. So it can be very helpful. In your sitting, whatever's going on, notice that when you really get into it, it's not there anymore. Try to observe your thoughts. The minute we pay attention to them, they're either gone or they stop. Bring awareness into the body. Anytime we bring awareness into the body, whatever is there, it's going to change within the next second or two. It can be helpful to note change when it takes place, so that when you're paying attention to sensations in the body, rather than simply paying attention to the sensations, pay attention to the changing nature of the sensations. Be aware of the sensation rising and falling. Be aware of the sensation as it moves from one part of the body to the next. Likewise with thoughts and with mind states. Just be aware of how it changes as you engage it directly. What makes it change when we bring awareness to it? Well, nothing makes it change because that's the inherent nature of it. Bringing awareness to it helps us see that inherent nature of it, you see. When we live in the reality of the present moment, we live in a dynamic universe. Everything is changing. Nothing's ever the same. Boredom is impossible. Because even boredom itself is a word. You know, when somebody says, I'm bored. All right, tell me about boredom. Oh, well, I'm antsy and I'm achy and I'm anxious and that doesn't sound boring. It sounds like there's something going on there, you see? That's not just a thing, but we give a label to a set of experiences. So going beyond the concept of impermanence to the experiential reality of impermanence can be a very powerful part of our practice. So I invite you to maybe play with that a little bit. And then moving on to the third characteristic, which is anatta, or no self, as it's sometimes called. Let me talk a little bit about the theory of it, and then once again we'll get into the practical application of it. There's a couple of ways to interpret the notion of no self. If we think of anicca, or impermanence, we can naturally segue into how that works with the sense of self. If everything is impermanent, that must mean that I'm impermanent. Well, yes. That's one way of looking at no self, is the meaning that there's no permanent self. That self is not a noun, as we usually think of it, but self is a verb. Self is an activity. You see, we live as if me, sometimes with a capital M, me, is a real, permanent, fixed thing, right? And it's the most important thing in the world, right? Of course. So we have this concept called me that organizes our experiences. It organizes our behavior, our relationships, this concept of me that I have. But if I explore that a little bit, you know, what is this me? Well, some days there's a happy me, some days there's a sad me, some days there's a competent me, some days there's an incompetent me, some days there's a me that feels good, some days there's a me that doesn't feel so good. In fact, all of that can happen in the same day sometimes. You see, when we pay attention to this thing called self, we notice that it's not permanent. It's always changing. You know, I look at a picture. I have a picture of myself when I was 2 years old. And I think, is that me? Well, I don't know. The body's different. The mind's different. The name's the same. Maybe that's the only thing that makes it me. You see, what is the me there? You see, but we have a memory, kind of like with the river. We say, well, this pattern of water is the river, and then we say this pattern of memories is me. That's how typically we identify ourselves. Is we have certain thoughts that we associate with past events, which may or may not have actually occurred, but nonetheless we have thoughts associated with past events that we call memories, and then those memories coalesce into a sense of self. And it's always interesting, of course, when you visit with a relative or a sibling or a parent and you talk about the past and you say, remember when this happened? And they'll say, no, no, that's not the way it happened. It happened this way. You beat me up. No, no, you beat me up. That's the way I remember, you see. So our memories can be very creative and impermanent as well. And yet we have a tendency to grab a hold of these memories and what we call memories and to objectify them into a sense of self. So that's another interesting meditation, is just looking at self. In fact, it's one you can do in your everyday life quite readily. Just go through your day experiencing your sense of self. Somebody compliments you, there's a happy self, a proud self. Somebody criticizes you, oh, there's a humiliated self or an angry self, you see. Feel good, there's a happy self. Feel bad, there's an unhappy self. There's a forgetful self, It's a hungry self, sleepy self, tired self. So when we look at this self, we see it is ever-changing. There's no absolute criteria by which we can define self, other than a set of memories and physical sensations that have frozen, so to speak, and frozen in our mind, not in reality, but frozen in our mind. And that's what we live from. But that's out of touch with the reality of who we are, because who we really are is a dynamic, open-ended, fluid activity of life, of the universe. But this living, spontaneous, alive, ever-changing stream of energy gets frozen by the concepts and by the resistances and the holdings that we have. Our self-identification, our memories from the past, what we love, what we hate, who we love, who we hate, how I am, how I'm not, these ideas, these self-images. That's why with all of us, it's so refreshing to see a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. And my grandchildren are my greatest teachers. And some of you may relate to that with your own kids or grandchildren. Young children are so refreshing because there isn't this frozen self. There isn't this history of me and you, and this is the way I am, and this is the way the world is, and this is the way it's supposed to be. Children are alive and open, and they'll say anything, and they'll do anything, and they don't give a damn what you think. They'll just do it, because they're this living field of energy. But of course, when we visit those same kids 10 years later, when they're teenagers, we see a very different set. We see a very frozen and restricted and a very patterned set of behavior, not the open, flowing, anything goes style of a very young child. So no self sounds like bad news, but it's ultimately wonderful news. And I often ask people, I'll say, tell me about a time when you've been very, very happy, very peaceful and very contented. Think about that time. Recall a time. And then I'll ask you the question, in that time period, what was your sense of self? Didn't know I had one. I was just enjoying the moment. I was just here on this mountaintop looking at this sunset, feeling peace with everything. There was no me. And then conversely, think about a time when you've been suffering a great deal, physically, emotionally, mentally. Where was the sense of self then? Oh yeah, it was there. It was very rigid. It was very solid. Very pronounced. I was very much aware of me. You see? And conversely, flip that around. Think about a time when you've been very self-conscious. When you've been very, very much aware of yourself as a entity, separate entity. What was that experience like? Pretty difficult, usually. Self-consciousness, the term we use, self-consciousness, is a painful, very painful experience. You know, the feeling of everybody's looking at me. Oh my God. The self comes in, you see. Or conversely, when you get lost in something and you forget yourself, you get lost in your art or your writing or a movie or a conversation, where is the sense of self there? What feeling arises when there's no self? usually quite pleasant, quite invigorating. When we go to bed at night, we lose our sense of self. It shows up in bits and pieces in our dreams, but for the most part, the self is gone. When we wake up in the morning, refreshed, where'd all that energy come from? Where does that energy come from when we sleep? It comes from the source of all energy when we surrender into it. But where we're at now, human beings, in our stage of evolution, about the only way we can really fully connect with that is by falling asleep. You see. When we fall asleep, we fall into the infinite stream of energy that is the universe, that is life, that is ever present. We stop closing it off. When we stop closing it off, we open ourselves up to it. And for most of us, the only way we know how to stop closing it off is to fall asleep. That's the way we let go of the self. But when there's no self, then we're open. When I say no self, I mean no concept of self. Then we're open. Then we're receiving rather than resisting the life energy that exists everywhere in the universe, in everyone. So it's so interesting that this sense of no self is often greeted with great skepticism and horror by many Westerners. No self? That's awful. Not really. It's really pretty good. What was it that Wes Nisker says? He says, you know, he says, I had a moment of enlightenment, but there was no self there to enjoy it. You know? That's the problem, you see? And that's what happens, is we have an experience of whatever, an epiphany or an awakening, and there's no self there. But then the self jumps up and wants to capture it, wants to talk about it, wants to recreate it, wants to write a book about it, wants to make money off of it, you see? And so we take the living truth and try to freeze it and try to own it. And that's what the self is an attempt to own some piece of this universe that can't be owned. It's an attempt to freeze something that can't be frozen because it's intrinsically alive and dynamic. Another aspect of no self, or another way to look at no self, is that of no separate self. When we talk about the conditioned universe, we talk about a universe where everything is dependent upon the existence or the non-existence of other things. So that in the natural universe, it's relatively easy to see that everything is related. Everything ultimately affects everything else. I mean, we're learning that with our ecology in the world, and we're learning it hopefully not too late to do something about it. But we're seeing how the way we live our life, you know, when I was growing up as a kid, there was very little, if any, connection made between the way human beings live their life and what happens in nature. Those were seen as two very different things. And it was only in the 60s and 70s was there the awareness that, hey, the way we live our life is affecting and impacting the natural world, and vice versa. So that we are intrinsically interrelated. That the idea of separateness is just that. It's just an idea. You could say, well, our bodies are separate. Well, that's true to a degree. But whether you like it or not, for the last day and a half, you know, you've been swapping atoms and molecules with everybody in this room. Every atom in your body was at one time in the body of every other living human being. Our eyes see a certain spectrum of light, and that spectrum of light reveals forms. But those forms exist only because that's the way we perceive them. You know, if we were seen through a different set of eyes, we wouldn't look nearly as separate as we are. We might look like stars in a galaxy. Many, many years ago, in the Hindu tradition, there was a story, I won't even say written, I think it was told long before it was written, about in Indra's net, Indra being the sky god, the god of the kind of comparable to Jehovah in the Old Testament. And Indra's net is a net, metaphorically, that spans the entire universe. And that net is made up of an infinite number of nodes connecting the net. Each node is like a pearl. And each node reflects every other node in the net. So that when you look at any node in the net, you're looking at the whole net itself. And today, we say that sounds like a holograph. Well, this was written or spoken about 4,000 or 5,000 years before the holograph was invented. But the idea that each of us is a unique and yet interconnected is the essential part of the wisdom tradition from both the West and the East. And in a sense, that's perhaps the true meaning of Sangha. The true meaning of Sangha is that we are not separate. We are all inherently one. The metta practice, the compassion practice, the practice of sympathetic joy are all ways of cultivating qualities of the mind in which we begin to recognize our innate oneness. So no self doesn't mean that I don't exist, but it means that my sense of isolation, my sense of separation from you, is an illusion. That doesn't exist. The separate self is not real. The separate self is the product of our resistances, our cravings, our memories, our cognitive processes. When we look at the natural world, we see systems within systems within systems within systems. We see atoms within molecules. We see molecules within organs, within cells. We see cells within organs. Organs within beings and bodies. And beings and bodies then form families and tribes and herds and clans and on and on and on, all the way up to the formation of the galaxies. We see that reality is nested one within the other. And ultimately, it's like Indra's net. When we look into one, we can see the whole thing. The poets have stated this many times. One of the classics is William Blake's line, you know, to see, what is it? To see infinity in a grain of sand and hold eternity in an hour. We see that in every moment that we're awake, we're touching eternity. And in every moment that we're awake, there is no separation. When there's no self, There can't be any separation. What is there to separate? Who is there to be separated? You see? So, we live at a very interesting juncture of time and space where science and religion, some religions, spiritual practice, is kind of converging around these ideas of impermanence and no self. And we can look to science, and we can look to the wisdom traditions of the religious traditions, and we can see remarkable parallels. And it's really an exciting thing to see. But so far, for most of us, it's just, isn't that a great idea? And our work now is to embody that idea and to live it, to recognize that that is the truth of our being, that we are not limited by time or space, and we are not imprisoned in this separate, isolated self, as it may seem.